Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. Today, we're going to look at the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 3, verses 15 to 16 and 21 to 22. This is the Gospel narrative of the baptism of the Lord. And as in so many, it's part of the whole Christmas idea of the Gospels that take the manifestation of Jesus to the world as a fundamental theme. And in the liturgical life of the Church, this extends actually from the birth of the Lord on the 25th of December through the idea of to the Epiphany, to the baptism of the Lord, and to the wedding feast of Cana. That this seems to be, even in the hymnology of the Church, these things are often lumped together as part of the manifestation of the Lord. The word Epiphany means manifestation of the Lord, the appearance of the Lord. And all of these are examples of the appearance of Jesus as the Son of God, the appearance of Jesus as both human and divine. So that we are dealing with very similar themes when we deal with the Nativity, the Epiphany, the Baptism, and the Wedding Feast of Cana. We're dealing with the human story, but it also is deeply imbued with the story of the presence of the divine. And it is a continuing reaffirmation of the incarnation of the Christ, meaning that he was not of simply human parentage, as the Gospel of John said, born not of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And so the story of the Annunciation, which is deeply embedded in Old Testament symbolism, moves forward through these Gospels. And we come today then to another manifestation of the Lord, another appearance of the Lord as both human and divine, in the story of the baptism of the Lord. The Gospel says, Luke's Gospel says, a feeling of expectancy had grown among the people who were beginning to think that John might be the Christ. So John declared before them all, I baptize you with water, but someone is coming, someone who is more powerful than I am, and I am not fit to undo the strap of his sandals, and he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and with fire. Fire was oftentimes seen in the Old Testament as a manifestation of the presence of the divine. And so the Spirit and the presence of God himself is going to be the fruit of the baptism of the Lord. It says a feeling of expectancy had grown among the people who were beginning to think that John might be the Christ. There was, at the beginning of the first century A.D., and the end of the last century B.C., there was a growing anticipation, a growing expectation that the Messiah, the great prophet, whoever they wanted to imagine him to be, was imminent. This is not something that is foreign to the whole phenomenon of human nature, nor to the whole phenomenon of human belief and human religion. We find that in times of great stress and great trial, there is a deepening of the sense of the otherness of God, and that in those tremendous days of great trial and great suffering, what we find then is people have a tendency then to be more open to the possibility of the divine. I had an interesting experience not long ago with this idea of the relationship between suffering and faith. That I attended a prayer service in which the petitions were all for the end of all suffering, and you know, articulating it item by item in a typical catalog of social justice reform and so forth. And afterward, an older woman came up to me and said something that to me was fascinating, and she said to me, if only they would understand how terrible this world would be if there were no suffering. And all of that was completely counterintuitive to the whole thrust of Christianity creating a utopian world, which is very much a part of modern Christianity and certainly a very strong component of contemporary Catholicism. But when you stop and think about it, when do we have the tendency to go more deeply into ourselves? And when do we have the tendency to make room within our own lives for the presence of the divine? And it is a life experiential reality that seldom do we do that when all is well with our lives. But when things go awry, when things are a struggle, when things are a trial, when things enter in over which we have no control, there is a tendency then to turn to prayer. I think a very common thing when people attend a funeral, especially all funerals have a certain element of sadness to them, because in some people's lives, all funerals in some way, shape, or form signify to them a personal loss. But so often you hear people say, well, I don't know how I would get through this without my faith. And that's legitimate. That's a fine thing to say. On the other hand, the other side of the coin is fascinating as well, that it is only in the tragedy that we realize that faith is a sustaining element of our life. I shouldn't say that. It's not only in tragedy, only in adversity, only in illness, only in any of those setbacks in life. But it certainly is an occasion for us to move more deeply into the mystery of the divine and to a greater sense of our own fragility and our own mortality. And this is part of also the grief of death. Not only is the loss of someone, but it is a radical confrontation with our own mortality. And so we have to say then that it, as an age, what the gospel is talking about, it's talking about a time when Jerusalem has fallen heavily under the heel of the Roman Empire, when there is very little room within first century Palestine for an authentic, independent practice of Judaism, that even the leaders of the church, of the covenanted people, of the chosen people, the leaders of the synagogue, have kind of abandoned their people and taken up in some way, shape, or form an alliance with the occupying powers, and creating, therefore, against them a very strong reaction, a sense of abandonment, a sense of aloneness on the part of the people, who then began to look more radically toward the living God to deliver them from the terrible situation that they are in. When we have watched Catholicism, for instance, collapse in traditionally Catholic areas, there is the possibility that, for instance, like when in Ireland, that the clerical caste, especially the diocesan clergy, were too often identified with the English overlords, and therefore the people felt really a sense of betrayal on the part of the clergy themselves in their individual and personal lives, which led them to an alienation and an anger and a sort of revolutionary spirit to identify the church with the diocesan clergy and then relish the opportunity to kind of overthrow them and kind of get out from underneath the heel. This is not an unusual cultural phenomenon. And so we need not be too concerned when the gospel is saying at the beginning of the first century, at the beginning of the birth of the Lord, and shortly before that, certainly during Rabbinic Judaism, that there is a messianic expectation growing and developing within Palestine, and that it is also the time when the Essene community moves out into Qumran, into the shores of the Dead Sea on the edge of the desert, and begins to ponder more deeply through the prophetic messages as to who this Messiah is to become. One of the people, one of the images that they come up with of the promise of the Messiah is in fact a prophet, a great prophet. Some believing that it is the return of Elijah. And so that becomes part of the popular expectation, the popular grasping for some signs of divine intervention in the midst of their suffering and their humiliation. When, and therefore, they think John might be the Christ, they are wondering, because John obviously has a prophetic voice. He has a prophetic way of life. He comes out of the desert. He is apparently a fiery preacher. He is someone who is calling the people of Jerusalem and the area around Jerusalem to an account for the way that they live and for the sinfulness of their society and so forth. And so they think, well, maybe this is the Christ. It is in John's interest to protect his own identity, to deny that he is the Christ, and therefore to point forward to another who is to come. This kind of is a prelude to the idea of Jesus coming to the shores of the Jordan and joining the great crowd that has come and listened to the prophet, the preacher, the Baptist. And so then the gospel says, when all the people had been baptized, and while Jesus, after his own baptism, was at prayer. So Luke does not go into the detail here, in this passage at least, into the baptism of the Lord, but he certainly goes into the consequences of the baptism of the Lord. And so Jesus now has entered into the waters of baptism. There is the dialogue, of course, with John, where John says, I'm not worthy to baptize you, and Jesus says, in order that the law might be fulfilled. In other words, that justice be done, in order that the will of God be done. This is God's will, that I be immersed in the fate and the destiny of my people, and that it is at that moment this submission to the waters of baptism, the submission to the prophet, the solidarity with the people who have gathered at the Jordan, the solidarity with those who live in the expectation of the coming of the Messiah, that Jesus then, having submitted himself to that, surrendered himself to that great sign of incorporation into the people of Israel, that the Holy Spirit descends on him in bodily shape, Luke says, like a dove. And a voice came from the heaven, you are my son, the beloved, my favor rests on you. So the theophany, the great manifestation, therefore, of Jesus as the Son of God, and certainly both Luke and the Gospel of John, when they speak of this, they are speaking in a sense of already having been imbued with the notion of God as triune, God as Father, Son, and Spirit. And they have already accepted the fact that Jesus is the incarnation of the Son of God, the incarnation of the Logos, the Word of God. John is particularly emphasizes this in a very particular sort of way through his whole prologue, which is an exegesis in some sense of the book of Genesis, and so ties the beginning of the proclamation of the Old Covenant with the beginning of the proclamation of the New Covenant. And so it is supposed to flow as it was at the visitation, with joy, the articulation and the expansion of the understanding of the nature of the relationship between the covenants appear both in the story of the visitation, in the prologue of John, and now also in the baptism of the Lord. For also then in this baptism of the Lord is the manifestation of the harmony between the old and the new covenant made clear. For Jesus submits to the baptism of John, the baptism of the old covenant, the cleansing, and yet emerges in a way with a new baptism, with a baptism more powerful, with a baptism imbued with the presence of the Holy Spirit, with a baptism in which God shares his life with his people. So that the baptism scene, like the visitation scene, is a sense of the peaceful and joyful Passover from the old covenant to its fulfillment in the new. This is a New Testament phenomenon and a New Testament teaching. There are those who would, in some way, shape, or form, see this as offensive to Judaism. And such, of course, has recently happened when Pope Benedict XVI indicated that the Old Testament is fulfilled in the New. And I think we've mentioned before some German intellectual with too much time on his hand began to rant about anti-Semitism on the part of Benedict. Well, if Benedict is anti-Semitic, so is the Jewish Jesus. And since that's obviously an absurdity, and especially in relationship with this gospel, where he allows himself to be totally embedded in the covenantal life of the Old Testament, in order that he might break through into its fulfillment in his person. It's basically an illogical and kind of an absurd position to take. Christianity has a right to be who it is, and so we should be able freely to navigate through the depths and the origins of our faith, the depths and the origins of the covenant under which we live, the covenant of the blood of the Lord. What happens then in this theophany of Jesus? This is a very interesting phenomenon. If Jesus is the Logos, if Jesus is the Word, if Jesus is the communicative principle of the Trinity, then whose voice is it that comes and proclaims in the Son? And it's here that we deal with the integrity of the three persons, bound together in relational love so tightly that they are one, that the voice of the Word might speak also through the person of the Father and the Spirit. And so what we have is not a contradiction saying, well, the Word is the communicative principle of the Trinity, and therefore the Father and the Spirit can't speak. That's not true, but they speak through the Word itself, and they so therefore speak through the Son. In a way, then, this is the divine element of Jesus testifying on behalf of the Father, to his incarnate presence in the midst of the world, and his integration then deeply into the mystery of the hope of redemption, the hope of salvation, the hope in Old Testament terms of deliverance from the slavery of sin and deliverance into the freedom of the children of God. The mission begins, in other words, in intensely. And it is from, therefore, this emerging from the Jordan at the testimony and the witness of the triune God, of the sonship of Jesus, that the whole new covenant begins now to be unfolded in the public arena of the people of Israel. And in so doing, to begin, therefore, the deliverance from the slavery and the kingdom of sinfulness and darkness. That which was the fruit of disobedience and the fruit of rejection, of trust and truthful, and the trust in and the truthfulness of the living God. For that's what was at stake in the Garden of Eden. It was, did the Lord speak the truth, or did the serpent speak the truth? Eve chose the serpent under the suffering of herself, her husband, and her progeny. And so what happens now is that the Word is once again to be spoken, this time in truth, and this time in a way embodied in the incarnate Christ, that it could not simply be something, an abstraction, but always, always remains embedded in the reality of Jesus Christ, in the reality of a person, which is why it is so essential in the whole authentic Christian tradition to maintain the continuing presence of the incarnate Christ, and not to reduce God, or not to reduce Jesus Christ to some pure spirit who hovers with the Father above us, but who is encased in the material creation exactly as he was at the Annunciation, and remains therefore with us in sacrament, in church, so that he might be with us as a counter distinction to the over-spiritualization of the faith. The faith is always an encounter with a person. It is never an ideology. It is never purely an idea. It is never purely some kind of a vague thought or a subjective feeling within our own selves. Encounter is fundamental to faith, and encounter is with the person of Jesus. We can encounter that person of Jesus in many, many different ways. Catholicism has striven to do that for centuries and centuries. It has done so in the reality of the sacrament of the Eucharist. It has done so in the devotional life, in the placing of imagery before us that we might concretize in some way, shape, or form in relation to our own lives. Something of the presence of the beyond, the presence of the divine in the midst of our world. It's very interesting that in the reforms that followed the Second Vatican Council, a reintroduction of the iconoclasm of the 9th century Eastern Church and also the iconoclasm of the Reformation returned with a vengeance into the Catholic world. And it's also interesting that probably at least with the destruction of that, of the imagery of faith in our world, probably almost half of our people turned away and found that they could no longer sustain a faith in the otherness of God without some kind of sense of an incarnational presence of the beyond. It is for this reason that the incarnation becomes so critical and so crucial to the whole phenomenon of Catholic belief. If we do not believe in the real presence, then we do not believe in the real God. It's in a way, it's so simple, because we cannot take that which Jesus was, both the existential and the ontological, both the human and the divine, both the material and the spiritual. We cannot take that and strip half of it away and still end up with a whole faith. We must have this, and Jesus promised us that, "Behold, I am with you all days until the consummation of the world." And he says that in the flesh, he says that in the body, he says that as the incarnate Christ at the end of Matthew's gospel when he appears to the disciples. So we then are caught in this business of trying to articulate in every age and every generation, of attempting to articulate the real presence of Christ in the midst of the world as an incarnate presence, while not in any way diminishing the spiritual nature of the divine, and without in any way trying to turn the divine into simply material idols of some kind. It is for those who do not believe in the continuing incarnation of the Christ, Catholic devotion has always been looked at askance as a sort of kind of idolatry, when in fact it is an attempt to recreate or to present in a palpable human form the wholeness of the living Christ and the wholeness of revelation. And without that devotional dimension in contemporary society, we fail in a very critical way. We fail to incorporate the whole idea of symbol into our faith. And this is one of the great crises of the modern faith, that when we strip the church of its symbolism of the divine and the human, then we strip the church of the depths and the real meaning of its faith. For those who would whitewash human imagination and take away from it the capacity to go beyond themselves in relationship to an incarnate presence of the divine, when we do that, we create a new Reformation society. We create the barren churches of Karlstadt Wittenberg. We actually then recreate the starkness of Calvin's houses of prayer. We do all of that kind of thing. And as a result, we lose the very core and the very heart of the Catholic life. Symbolism is for us oftentimes seen as a flat surface, as something that simply points to something else. But in real terms, in the terms of the early church, in the terms of the fathers of the church, in the terms of the very depth of Catholic theology, that symbolism is different than that. Symbolism is that which contains that which it represents. That if, in fact, and I think that we can see this quite clearly, if, in fact, the only avenue we have to faith is human narrative, if that's all we have, then we create a human phenomenon, and it is devoid of that deeper reality, that deeper presence of the living God. And that human reality may be a very fine ethical society. It may be a very helpful way within society for us to move, but it does not communicate to us either the depth of the presence of God or the depth of our own meaning as human persons. And so the destruction of ancient symbolism within the church is the destruction of an authentic faith in the living God. This might seem radical. It might seem in some way, shape, or form beyond the pale. But basically, if we stop and think about it, unless we have symbol to take us beyond ourselves into the world of what might even be involve our own imagination, and certainly Ignatius of Loyola strongly understood that, strongly advocated that, strongly introduced that into the life of the early society of Jesus, that once we have dispensed with that which carries us beyond ourselves, we have dispensed with an openness to the living God. We have somehow or other lost the idea that God is greater than we are and that God is other than we are, in us and among us, but other as well. If we simply try to articulate all of this reality in human narrative, in discursive discussion, we lose the essence of the whole kerygma. We lose the essence of revelation, and we lose an understanding of the incarnation of Christ. This becomes very clear in a great deal of modern theology, which has returned to the ancient heresy of adoptionism, in which Jesus is no longer seen as the divine reality. And you find that in a great deal of contemporary German philosophy and German theology, actually. And that somehow or other he is someone lifted up by the Spirit of God and entered into a sonship with God without it being an integral unity where God becomes, in fact, the Father of the incarnate Christ in the Annunciation and through the flesh of the Virgin Mary. We have to be very careful of this, and hopefully we can talk about this also as the Gospels move on and as we go on with our reflections and our ideas. Without real symbolism, without a symbolism that contains what it represents, we cannot have entree or access into the understanding or the touching or the experience of the presence of the living God among us. And that therefore our encounter with the person of Christ as other, the door to that is closed for us when all we have is narrative. And when we do not have symbol and image, and we are not drawn from deep within ourselves to encounter that which we do not know and understand, but which we touch through existential phenomenon, existential reality. This is critical, and this is what happens when Jesus emerges from the waters of the Jordan. In the existential sign of baptism, he emerges in solidarity with the people of Israel, and as he does so, is proclaimed through the voice of God to be divine. This is critical, and without this, there is no true Christianity, and without this, there is no authentic faith.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com. Then he